Blog Talk Radio. To the Words on Flick show on eWater Radio, KEWRDB. Hi there, how are you? Welcome to the Words on Flick show, movie talk from a fan perspective with me, entertainment journalist, blogger, and big movie fan, Janine Coveney. And I hope that you know when I say movie fan, I like today's movies, but I often end up talking about movies from the past, because it seems like in the past I had a whole lot more time to even watch movies. I can't keep up with today's movies. I try, but, you know, it's an ongoing challenge. But anyway, I hope that you had a marvelous Easter and Resurrection holiday. And for my Jewish friends still marking the Passover season, I salute you too. I had a great show last week discussing some of the films representing Jewish culture with my friend, entertainment writer turned psychiatric social worker, I can't even say it, Judy Rosen. And if you'd like to hear it, you can find it on the Blog Talk Radio platform or via the link on the Words on Flicks Facebook page. Wait, what? You're not on the Words on Flicks Facebook page? It is a closed group, but you can ask to be on it, and of course, I'll let you on. I'm also kind of in the process of moving some of the shows to SoundCloud, so for posterity, so you might look for me there as well, but that's an ongoing process. So anyway, this week, it's all about William Shakespeare, y'all, the Bard of Stratford-on-Avon. Now, let me tell you, when I was at Hunter College High School in Manhattan, you know, we were all about the English program, so we read a lot of Shakespeare. But, you know, as with most things that kids are forced to read, and don't get me wrong, I loved reading and English was my best subject. I didn't really understand, like, oh my gosh, why do we have to read this guy, you know, from hundreds and hundreds of years ago? Like, you can't even understand the language. Why is it so important? I just wanted somebody to explain to me why these tragedies and comedies and soliloquies and monologues and all of this stuff was so important to us. And I think only now do I understand. I'll have a couple more comments about that in a minute. But anyway, Shakespeare is the purported writer. He's the writer of some 37 plays, 154 sonnets, and 3 narrative poems. And his birthday was celebrated on April 23rd. He was born in 1564. So happy 455th birthday, Will Shakespeare. And who would think that 455 years after his birth, we would still be celebrating his works? And that's what's so amazing to me, that how much of it has survived intact. And we're still using many of his turns of phrases in our lexicon and all of that. So tonight I wanted to talk a little bit about Shakespeare-related films, because there's no shortage of them, let me tell you. And just a couple of my favorite Shakespeare-themed screen adaptations. So I wrote a lot of notes for tonight, and I have no idea what the timing on it is. I may actually run out of commentary. There's no guest tonight, so I'm just going to regale you with some things you probably already know and maybe some things you didn't, or it'll just be nice for you to hear it all in one place. So somehow this conversation that I put together might take us to Broadway and Steven Spielberg and Puerto Rico and Nathan Lane and Denzel Washington. Oh, my. And I don't know if there's a little time left, again, because I don't know how I've timed this. I don't know. Sometimes an hour seems really long, and then sometimes it just flies right by. So hopefully you'll stay with me. And maybe if there's time at the end, I can talk about some of the films that I've seen recently, including Little, which I think is so cute, The Amazing, Amazing Grace, and maybe a little bit about La Llorona. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. So with all of that, get in your Shakespearean mood, and now we'll go back because I'll play you a little music. And I'm sure this will bring you back to when you were a small child. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep no more, and by asleep to say we end the heartache and the thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, 'tis a consummation devoutly to be wished. To die, to sleep, perchance, to dream, aye, there's the rub, for in that sleep of death, what dreams may come, when we have shuffled off this mortal coil, must give us pause. That is Hamlet's famous soliloquy on contemplating suicide as he grapples with the death of his father, the betrayal of his uncle and mother who plotted his father's death and then, oh my goodness, got married, practically standing on his grave. And now Hamlet's also dealing with pushing aside Ophelia, whose love he cannot return, as he tries to figure out how he's going to take his revenge. So I hope you don't mind my putting on my Shakespearean voice to read that famous soliloquy that so many others have attempted. So Hamlet is probably among the best known and most produced plays in the Shakespeare canon. And of course, you know, everybody from Sir Laurence Olivier, I think that was 1948, to Nicol Williamson in 1969, to Mel Gibson in 1990. I like that version. To Kenneth Branagh in 1996, which I did not see. Ethan Hawke in 2000. They've all taken it on. And, you know, I haven't seen the Ethan Hawke version that came out in 2000, which was updated to contemporary time. So it's modern dress, modern times, but with the Shakespearean language. And it has a great cast, apparently. It's got Kyle MacLachlan as his Uncle Claudius, with Diane Venora as Gertrude Lee of Schreiber, as Laertes, and Julia Stiles, who keeps showing up in these Shakespearean films as Ophelia. And it's also got Steve Zahn and Bill Murray and Sam Shepard as the murdered king, the ghost of the elder Hamlet. And like I said, I haven't seen it. I just happened to watch a YouTube video of the To Be or Not To Be soliloquy with Ethan Hawke. And I was like, what the heck is this? He's sort of wandering around a Blockbuster video store in a, you know, in a, I don't know what you call those hats. It's like a ski hat, you know, with the flaps and the tassels. Anyway, he's kind of like walking around Blockbuster mumbling to himself. And I thought, I don't know. Maybe somebody can call and tell me how fabulous that version is, but I'm going to have to pass on that one. Is not my favorite of the Shakespeare plays, but I thought I'd mention it in case you guys have a favorite. So let me know. You can call in as a guest. You can call on your phone, and I can open up the mic and see what you have to say. It's area code 323-642-1757. And as I said, you can call in and share your thoughts on Shakespeare if you've got a fave Shakespeare flick. As I was saying, it's fascinating to me that the written works of someone who lived so long ago, like in a completely different age with different customs, look, different clothes, you know, different bathrooms, completely different manner of existence in another country, in another language. Well, it's not another language, it's England. I guess I'm thinking it's another language because so many of his plays seem to be set in Italy. But we're still living his situations because he really understood human nature so well. And that was the point of all of those English classes in high school that we suffered through. He understood human nature. He understood a plot, how to put together a narrative plot that holds our interest, a major plot, a secondary plot. He wrote about everything, love, passion, hate, you know, enmity, war, the war between the sexes, sibling rivalry. He had, you know, witches and knights and kings and courtesans and, you know, also just jealousy, madness, like a lot of mad people, people with mental health issues show up. And this is life, right? So not much has changed since Shakespeare's time. So as I said, we're still using a lot of his language and phrases today. And, you know, even in film works that are not specifically about Shakespeare, his words and his works are still showing up, like this piece from Hair.
What a piece of work is man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable, in action how like an angel, in apprehension how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals, have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth. This goodly frame, the earth seems to me a sterile promontory.
This most excellent canopy, the air, look you, this brave o'erhanging firmament, this majestic roof, threaded with golden fire. Why, it appears no other thing to me than a foul and pestilent congregation of vapors.
What a piece of work is man, how noble in reason.
Okay, so I didn't edit that quite right, but that's okay. I know you're still with me. Of course, that's from Hair, the original Broadway cast recording with the late Ronnie Dyson singing that there with a beautiful voice, lead voice. And I love that because the way that the music is so, you know, the cadence of it, it really helps the words stick to your brain. And as a kid, I was really, you know, enraptured by this language. I didn't know what it means, but now I find myself quoting it when I'm feeling a little down and depressed, because basically it's saying, you know, nothing in the earth or sky engages me now. I've lost all my mirth. I have no happiness. I have no smiles left. I'm, you know, everything around me just looks like crap. But of course, Shakespeare didn't say it that way. He had to say it in a fancy and beautiful poetic way. So there you go. Perhaps the best known of Shakespeare's works, the ones that we had to parse through the most in high school, and, you know, who knows, maybe you were even in a high school production of it, is Romeo and Juliet, the best known romance ever. And of course, that the theme from the Zeffirelli movie is what I played at the top of the show. You know, the story is still relevant and is the backbone of the most well-known romance plot, star-crossed lovers, families that are not the same and who object, cultures that are not the same and who object to their young people crossing the line and attempting to love or marry. And this is popular, and I have to say that after I'd seen it performed a couple of times on stage and in movies, it has become one of my favorites. And in particular, the 1968 Franco Zeffirelli version, the definitive version, for most people. And by the way, Zeffirelli is still alive, I discovered. He's like 96 years old. That man just keeps going and going. So, of course, he's the Italian film director and opera producer. I've seen a couple of his opera productions in the movie theater, thanks to the Metropolitan Opera in New York being broadcast live to movie theaters across the country. It's a long movie watch, but if you like opera and you can't get to the Met in New York, check it out. I saw him do Turandot, which had great, great, great costumes. It's set in China, ancient China. It was amazing. Anyway, Romeo and Juliet. For this Romeo and Juliet, he made the then daring move to cast actual teenagers as the stars, because all previous productions had been like these older, established Shakespearean actors. And of course, when you're studying Shakespeare, if to really get the language and the meaning correct, to get the cadence of the words, the lines right, you really have to study many years. And I'm sure that study includes understanding the culture of the time in which it was written so that you can really speak the words with true intention. And I remember I was talking about this a little bit with Mr. Owens, Jeffrey Owens, who is a big Shakespeare enthusiast as well, when he was on the show a couple of weeks back, and we were so glad to have him. But yeah, Leonard Whiting was 17 when he played Romeo, and Olivia Hussey was just 16 at the time. And apparently, because they were so young and just getting started in their acting careers, some of the speeches from the play were cut down, significantly cut or adapted, so that they could focus on the things that they did best, which was look amazing and, you know, concentrate on their chemistry together in the film. And so also that Zeffirelli version stars a very young Michael York as Tybalt the Cat, who is Juliet's cousin, who, you know, I'm sure I'm not giving away any spoilers. I mean, we know this play. Tybalt is killed by Romeo. And of course, we remember Michael York from Cabaret in 1972, playing opposite Liza Minnelli. And it's funny because I just watched Logan's Run again not that long ago with Jenia Gutter, that sci-fi thing. If you haven't seen Logan's Run, it's quite a hoot. You should check it out. Very early futuristic sci-fi. Like, they shot it in the mall. It looks like the Century City Mall in California. I don't know. So, anyway, Friar Lawrence is also played by Milo O'Shea in this version, who's a well-known character actor who played Duran Duran in Barbarella, among many other roles. Anyway, the film looks fantastic because, being Zeffirelli, he had to shoot it on location in many Renaissance Italian locations with the original architecture dating back to the 14th century, which gave the film a real sense of place and history. And I just love this film. If it's on, I'm watching it because it's so eye-filling and it really takes you back to that time. And the performances are pretty good. Now, of course, the Shakespearean language is pretty, you know, elaborate, but you can get the sense of it, no doubt. And of course, you know, if you want to take out the play, take out your old dog-eared copy of Romeo and Juliet and check it out once again. I wasn't old enough to see it in the theater when it first came out, but I remember it came back to theaters when I was in high school. And so a little quick personal story is that I had met some guy who was, I think he went to Dartmouth at the time, and I think I was still in high school, and he was the son of a friend of my parents. I don't know. They were like, oh, you should meet him. He wants to take you out. And I was like, okay, he's going to do what I want to do. So he's like, oh, we should go to the movies. What do you want to see? I want to see Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet, because I was that nerdy, pain in the ass, egghead girl. And so he did. He drove to get me, and you know, we went to Manhattan and went to see Romeo and Juliet, and I'm sure that I totally ignored him. Like, I really wasn't interested in him. I wanted to, well, I shouldn't say that. While we were in the theater, all I wanted to do was see the film. And that's generally how I am, unfortunately. If you go with me to the movies, you better not talk during the movie. Better not talk. Don't ask me what they just said. Don't nudge me. Don't pull my attention away from the screen, because I'm living in that movie until it's over, unless it's bad. And even if it's bad, I'm going to watch it so I can see why it's bad. We can talk about it afterwards. But anyway, that's my little Romeo and Juliet story. I think afterwards he was kind of disappointed because all I wanted to do was talk about the movie, and, you know, it wasn't his type of movie. But anyway, that's my little personal story. Ha ha. So Australian director Baz Luhrmann also directed his updated version, which I'm sure you've seen, of Romeo and Juliet's story. And, you know, in his update, he put, instead of the ampersand, he put a plus sign. So it's Romeo plus Juliet, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Claire Danes, of course. And, you know, there's a great supporting cast, the late, great Brian Dennehy, who I've always loved, as Romeo's father. It's got John Leguizamo as Tybalt, Pete Postlethwaite as Friar Lawrence, Paul Sorvino and Diane Vernora as the Capulets, and shout out to actor and director Vondi Curtis Hall. He's my Facebook friend. I don't know how. Who plays the prince as Captain Prince, chief of police. And then another one of my favorites is Harold Perrineau, who plays Mercutio, who's Romeo's kind of mad, crazy friend, who's ultimately killed by Tybalt. And then Paul Rudd, who shows off, you know, his versatility. I've seen Paul Rudd in so many different things. Like, you know, we associate him with comedies, but I've seen him in some dramas as well. And, you know, he's pretty diverse. You know, he's pretty versatile. Anyway, he plays Paris, who's like Juliet's father's pick to be her husband. And he's like the perfect dude. So the great thing about this Romeo and Juliet is that, and I know a lot of people don't necessarily like it, but it's updated to modern times. It's set in Florida, basically. Well, we assume it's Florida. And it's not Verona, it's Verona Beach, which is funny because, of course, the coast of Florida has all these beach communities. And there is a heavy, heavy, heavy Latino influence in the styling, setting, costuming, design, production design. In terms of the lowrider cars, Cuban heels, tattoos, earrings, you know, the tropical look of it, and these insanely stylized guns as weapons. It's, again, it's an elaborate, eye-filling over-the-top production, which is typical of Baz Luhrmann, of course. He's always over-the-top. And many parts of the movie were shot in, I believe, in Mexico City and Veracruz in Mexico, as well as in Florida. And Baz Luhrmann being Baz Luhrmann, of course, there's like these sort of cartoonish parts to it and, you know, these little flourishes that you're like, well, I could live without that. But I love it because there's so much to look at. And within it, there's some strong performances, but then you have some people who are just kind of over the top. They were told to just blah, go for it. And so the tone of the film is a little uneven because, of course, you have Leonardo DiCaprio, who's so intense and serious, and then you have like a big jokester like, you know, Leguizamo joking around. And then, of course, Harold Perrineau as Mercutio, he really takes it over the top. Like, one of my favorite scenes is when all of them, Romeo and his boys, are crashing the Capulets' costume party. And of course, you know, Mercutio shows up as Harold Perrineau in a white Afro wig and a skirt and heels, and he's dancing to Young Hearts Run Free, which is like one of my favorite disco songs. Anyway, again, over the top. But DiCaprio's performance, I think, is pretty good. There's a scene, that scene when he's banished from Verona, and he's living in a trailer out, way out in this deserted, I don't know what you would call it, this deserted area, unincorporated area. And, of course, in the original, you know, his friend sends them a message that Juliet has, quote unquote, died, and he's running to tell him. And in this version, it's the FedEx man. The FedEx man is bringing him a letter and, you know, misses him and leaves him a, you know, we came by and you weren't here, slapped on the door of his trailer, which I think is kind of funny and kind of clever. And of course, the final scene in the church is beautiful, when Claire Danes is all laid out, you know, she's taken the potion that gives her this appearance of sleeping death, and now she's lying in repose, and all of those candles, and Romeo comes in, and he's just desperate to find her dead. That scene gets me every time. Don't ask me why. So it's a combination of the imagery, the soundtrack is really good. But again, it's an acquired taste. Like, Baz Luhrmann is an acquired taste for a lot of people, and for me as well. But I'll watch this again, Romeo plus Juliet. And, of course, we know that this has inspired so many love stories, film love stories. And the most obvious inheritor of the mantle of Romeo and Juliet is, of course, West Side Story from 1960, which is one of the most fantastic musicals of all time. I think it's more a modern-day musical than sort of like the ones from the 40s and 50s, of course, directed by Jerome Robbins, who also did the choreography, and then Robert Wise batted cleanup on it. And it's got great music, music by Leonard Bernstein, and I believe Stephen Sondheim did a lot of the lyrics. It's just wonderful. It was adapted from the popular Broadway musical in the 1950s. And as you know, everybody knows Natalie Wood, who is Russian by descent, by heritage, plays Maria. Richard Boehmer plays Tony. And Rita Moreno plays Anita, the only Puerto Rican in a film about Puerto Ricans in New York. George Chakiris, who I believe is Greek, plays Bernardo, and Russ Tamblyn plays Riff. So, again, no Puerto Ricans in the film except Rita Moreno, and, of course, she's fantastic, and she wins an Oscar for her portrayal. And it's great music, great dancing. We all know the songs, Tonight, Tonight, Maria, 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 and all of that. So I can't help but think of that joke that people tell, like, okay, so you're in New York at that time in an immigrant neighborhood. You go into the street and you scream out Maria, And only one girl comes to, there's only one girl in the whole neighborhood named Maria. That's funny to me. And maybe it's funny because I grew up in New York. Anyway, so I won't dwell on that West Side Story, except to say that there's a remake due, and it's being directed by Steven Spielberg with a script by Tony winner Tony Kushner. He's fantastic. But I don't know, Steven Spielberg, he's not a musicals director by any stretch. So I'm wondering how this is going to play out. He's a great visual storyteller, and no disrespect to him, but I'm wondering how this is going to turn out. So he did a big major open casting call in January because they do want to do culturally correct casting. So they did a big casting call in New York in January, and they were able to cast the main roles and all the, you know, the jets and the sharks all together, about 40 different roles. And so it looks to me that a lot of the folks that were cast in the film, most of them are Broadway folks. I don't really know a lot of these names. The only name I know, okay, so I'll give it to you. Let's see. Leading the jets as Riff will be Mike Face. So he was in Dear Evan Hansen and Newsies. But Puerto Rican singer and dancer Ana Isabel will play Rosalia, who works with Maria. Okay, but who's the main people? Okay, previously announced. So Rita Moreno will appear in the film again. Oh, my goodness, this lady's over 80. She's amazing. I'm glad she's going to be in the new version. So what's going to happen is she's going to play a character named Valentina, who is going to be the Doc role. Remember, Doc was the owner of the candy shop, who was sort of like the, almost like the Friar Lawrence character to Romeo. He advised Tony. So that's who Rita is going to play. And then you have Ansel Elgort, who's a film star, playing Tony. Ariana DeBose will be Anita. David Alvarez will be Bernardo. Josh Andres Rivera Chino. Where's my Maria? Did I already say Maria? I'm going to have to look that up. I think maybe, I already did say Maria. I am tired. So anyway, I'm not sure when this is coming out, but you better believe I'm going to be looking out for it, because I understand that in the producer's drive to make sure that it is culturally correct, they want to get it right this time, because so many culturally, native Puerto Ricans and Puerto Ricans who grew up in New York, who are known as Neoricans, they love the film, or they deride the film, but either way, they still complain because Puerto Ricans did not play Puerto Ricans in this Hollywood version. So I understand that they've had panel discussions, and they've gone to Puerto Rico to talk to arts and culture representatives down there about what the film means to them and going forward what they would like to see. And I think that's admirable. I'm just worried about a film that's going to be almost like totally redone. I'm all for making it culturally correct, but we don't like our cultural touchstones to be altered too much. So we'll see what happens. You'll see what happens. So moving on from there, let's see. I think I'm up to the darker side of Shakespeare. Yeah, let's go there. Maybe that'll be best, because, and I'll come back to when it gets a little fun again. So hold on, I'm going to get myself together here to talk about some things. But speaking of West Side Story, I had a little clip for you, and you'll really enjoy the voice.
There place for us. Somewhere there is a place for us. Peace and quiet, no open air. It waits for us somewhere.
So that's a little Aretha there, and of course her playing the piano as well on Somewhere, which is a theme from the West Side Story movie, and it's always delightful to hear Aretha, and maybe at the end of the show I'll get to talk a little bit more about Aretha. But as I mentioned, I'm going to move into the darker side of Shakespeare right now, his tragedies. So among one of my favorite films, I don't know, I'm getting some feedback on here. I don't know what's going on with that. And I know that kind of messed up the playback. But anyway, I'm going to move forward. So one of my favorite, I don't know if it's my favorite, but it was most eye-opening of the tragedies. And I didn't know it as well until I saw it in the theater. It's called Titus from 1999 with Anthony Hopkins, who's an actor I happen to love. And it's directed by Julie Taymor, who is a fantastic director and production designer herself. She is the person behind The Lion King and all the costumes and the staging for The Lion King. And she's done a whole bunch more, but that's what she's best known for. And so this production of Titus, taken from Titus Andronicus, also has her production eye to it. It's fantastic to look at. It's set in Roman times. Titus is a Roman general, but there's so many modern twists to it. It's sort of like a modern take on ancient Rome, particularly in the costumes and the settings. You still have the Shakespearean language. It also stars Jessica Lange, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. It's got Alan Cumming and Harry Lennox. Shout out to Harry Lennox, one of my favorite actors, also a journeyman actor. And in addition to it being so eye-popping, this is also one of Shakespeare's most violent, jaw-dropping, oh my God, tragedies. Now, certainly he's known for his body count in many of the films, but not only do people die in Titus, they die in truly horrible, horrible ways. And, you know, I wish I could really recount the entire plot to you. And when you get into Shakespearean plots, you're really diving into the deep end of the pool because, of course, you have all these different characters, and you have people who are jealous and people who are in love and people with good intentions, people with bad intentions, and it gets very, very, very complicated. But the best I can say is that Titus Andronicus is a Roman general who's just returned victorious from war, and he brings, you know, prisoners of war, hostages. So he's got Tamora, queen of the Goths, who is Jessica Lange, and her sons, and, you know, he kills the oldest son in exchange for all of his Roman dead. So her son is sacrificed. And then, you know, there's all this political maneuvering and between her sons, his sons, who's going to marry the queen, who's going to marry Titus's daughter, Lavinia. And even that, like, poor Lavinia. Lavinia is supposed to marry, one of the suitors, one of the Goth sons. And they take her out into the woods on a ride, and they rape her and, you know, torture her. And so in order for her not to be able to tell that she was raped and assaulted, they cut off her hands and cut out her tongue. And so she is found just wandering around the countryside after this attack by her father and taken back to the castle. But lo and behold, she can still communicate, yo, because she can hold a stylus in her mouth and scratch out the names of her attackers, God love her. But it being a Julie Taymor production, in place of her hands, there are now these tree branches. I don't know how to explain it. I mean, you have to see it. It is unbelievable. Also, Tamora, played by Jessica Lange, she's in a political marriage but she's also been having an affair with Aaron the Moor, played by Harry Lennox. And so she secretly gives birth to this mixed-race child, which is like, okay, Moors show up a few times in Shakespeare's works, right? So she has this child, and then Aaron kills the midwife to keep her from telling about the baby, and he spirits this child away. He's so excited that he has a son. He has a bunch of soliloquies about my son. And but in order to protect the son, he ends up having to reveal, he's captured, and he ends up having to reveal Tamora's revenge plan. So now that Titus knows what Tamora has in store, he's got some stuff in store for her. So a lot of people die in this. You know, there's rape, adultery, and, you know, people are sliced, run over, dragged, beheaded, and then somebody's put in a pie to be served. Oh, would you like some of this revenge bloody pie? Oh, yes. Anyway, violent, it's cold-blooded, y'all. And I think that's what the fascination of it is for me. I mean, it's not a very nice play, and it gets very, very complicated. But this movie is a nice entry, if this is what you're interested in. It's a good, and no better person to usher you in than the great Anthony Hopkins. So speaking of Titus and how Shakespeare lives on and on and on, just this past week, you have a new play on Broadway titled Gary, a sequel to Titus Andronicus, starring Nathan Lane. Gary is briefly alluded to in the play as a domestic, but here in the play he becomes the main character, so he's just a flunky who has to clean up all this bloody carnage from the Titus maneuvers to make his entry hall ready for the coronation of the new king. So poor Gary, you know, he's got some helpers, but there is literally in the production design of the Broadway show a pile
of dead bodies, which are, you know, mannequins and dummies. But, you know, he's got a it's a Shakespearean workplace comedy, if you will, because there's jokes about working and cleaning up and how to make this all right. And it's actually gotten a mix of reviews. Like, some people think it's fantastic and inventive, and some people think, you know, it's too hard to make a laugh-out-loud comedy when there's dead bodies and blood spurts laying around. So I get that. I get that. So that is Titus, y'all. If you can find it, I don't know if it's available on Netflix. I need to check that out because I want to see it again. It's really visually stunning, and it'll just drop your jaw. On the lighter side, ta-da, is the comedy Much Ado About Nothing. Aren't you glad we left the Titus fields of gore and carnage for Much Ado About Nothing? The 1993 version seems to be a favorite for a lot of folks. So, of course, Kenneth Branagh, particularly during the 90s, he really took on this mantle of staging and filming a lot of popular Shakespeare works. So he's directed and starred in several of them throughout the 90s, and Much Ado About Nothing is one of them. He did it in 1993. It's a British-American production, and he stars as Benedick in the film with his then-wife, Emma Thompson, starring as Beatrice, who are the two main characters. And so it's a battle between the sexes in which, you know, sharp-tongued, super-smart Beatrice has decided, you know, I'm not going to marry. Who needs men? You know, they're going to have to do a lot better and be a lot smarter and a lot sharper than they make them for me to get tied down. You know, and so that point of view was perhaps revolutionary during those times because she's very independent and because she's so jaded about it, but also she's funny and she's quick-witted and fun. She still attracts a lot of attention, but she doesn't want to get tied down. But her former lover, Benedick, shows up at her family's mansion, I believe, to celebrate a victory in battle, bunch of soldiers. I don't have the exact plot, but it's delightful because you have a house full of people who are now celebrating and carousing, and then love ensues between the secondary characters. So you've got Kate Beckinsale in her first film role, and Robert Sean Leonard, who wants to marry her. But then Denzel Washington shows up as well. In a role, and he's Don Pedro. He's kind of like this wise older brother type to Keanu Reeves's evil scheming Don John. So Don John is trying to, you know, besmirch Hero's reputation, who is the Kate Beckinsale character. And so the film is all fun and games and gambling and carousing in the sun and lots of billowing white dresses and, you know, flowing white shirts. Remember the Prince Puffy shirt? It's lots of that. And riding boots and, you know, it's very, you know, it's very precious. But it's sort of fun. It's got a great pace to it. But it's not my favorite version. It's just a little bit too precious for me. I actually like the more contemporary version, which was adapted and directed by Joss Whedon in 2012, and he shot it in black and white at his house in Santa Monica, California, with actors he worked with on several of his TV series. So that includes Amy Acker, Alexis Denisov, Nathan Fillion. I really like Dennis Fillion in this because he plays a role that could be kind of cartoonish, and he, you know, he ups the comedy, but he doesn't go over the top the way Michael Keaton does in the Kenneth Branagh version. So like I said, it's shot in black and white and has a very slick sort of Brat Pack type feel to it. So depending on what you like I said, a lot of people love the Kenneth Branagh 1993 version. I could sort of take it or leave it. Now, the thing about Much Ado About Nothing is it's supposed to be a lighthearted comedy. You know, Beatrice and Benedick are kind of like trading barbs, and everybody knows that they're supposed to be together, but they keep professing that they can't stand each other, and it takes the whole play for them to actually come together. And that part is fun. It's just the secondary story about the other girl who's supposed to get married, and her reputation is besmirched. It is staged that she is seen, quote unquote, making love with another man. So she is not a maid. She is not a virgin. So they actually go through with the marriage, and of course the bridegroom just explodes and attacks her and besmirches her. And so that idea that a girl can be ruined because of her reputation is still disturbing to this day. And I know it was a very real thing, and it's still for many people a real thing. Like, your reputation, if not your sexual reputation, your professional reputation should not have a blemish on it before you tie the knot with somebody else. I don't know. So that's Much Ado About Nothing. And it doesn't seem like nothing to her, to Hero, because she takes the brunt of the tragic action in this film. She's crying and carrying on. Anyway, speaking of the Battle of the Sexes in Shakespeare, you have to go back to Zeffirelli yet again for the classic Taming of the Shrew from 1967. This was Zeffirelli's first film ever, and it actually came before Romeo and Juliet. And the movie stars the immortal Elizabeth Taylor as Catherine and Richard Burton as Petruchio. And this film had all the Zeffirelli hallmarks in terms of the gorgeous set design. It's got elaborate costumes, period music, and those big, eye-popping Renaissance Italian settings. And of course, he's got like the wide screen lens that lets you take in all of this visual information, all this color, and of course Italian architecture and art, and you know, the lifestyle of the times with the animals, and the, you know, the clothing that they wore was very, especially for the men, was very peacock like and then of course you have Liz and Dick there, who are chewing up the scenery admirably. And I don't think this film is shown as often as the Zeffirelli Romeo and Juliet, but you know, Taming of the Shrew is a classic. And again, so many other more modern films are based on that idea of two warring lovers, a male and a female. And also in this, it's sort of like, again, the title says it all, The Taming of the Shrew. She's a shrew. She's loud. She's obnoxious. She's independent. That's her biggest fault. Kate is independent. And so at the end of the film, you know, Kate gives into love with this big submission speech about how women should be soft and peaceful and serve their husbands. And you're like, really, Liz? It's you, Liz. Are we gonna buy this? But anyway, this shrew is the basis of one of my favorite Hollywood musicals, Kiss Me, Kate, from which the tune Brush Up Your Shakespeare is taken. And it's from 1953 with Howard Keel as Petruchio and Catherine Grayson in the Kate part. I don't think that's their actual names. They play actors who are putting on a musical version of The Taming of the Shrew. So they're in those classic roles, and in real life they're in this push and pull about whether to rekindle their own love affair. And it's delightful, and it's got great, great songs in it. And, of course, the film 10 Things I Hate About You from 1999, set in a high school, was adapted from it. It's a teen comedy with Julia Stiles, Heath Ledger, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and a lot of people seem to like that film. So just, that's basically all I really have time for. Just quickly, certainly there's dozens more adaptations I could talk about. There's Othello, again, directed by Kenneth Branagh in 1995 with, he plays the creepy Iago to Lawrence Fishburne's, Othello, and Irene Jacob plays Desdemona. And then there's the high school adaptation called with Mekhi Phifer, also starring Julia Stiles. And Tim Blake Nelson directed it. I did not know that till recently. Tim Blake Nelson stars in the Coen Brothers film. I can't think of it. It was just nominated for an Oscar about the singing cowboy. I'll come back to that. You know what I'm talking about. And then another one of my favorites that I didn't really have time to get into is Richard III with Ian McKellen, 1995. What is it about the 90s and all these, as I said at the top of the show, I guess the only time I could really watch all these movies was in the 90s. Anyway, Richard III is awesome. It's updated to World War II era England, like 1930s England. So, of course, you have the 1930s style clothing. Then you have, like, a lot of kind of Nazi iconography. But you know that they're in war. And the cast is Annette Bening, Jim Broadbent, Robert Downey Jr., Nigel Hawthorne, Kristen Scott Thomas, Maggie Smith, Dominic West. It's awesome. So anyway, thank you for listening to me ramble on about all of my Shakespeare-related films. Like I said, there's plenty more I could get into, and I didn't touch on a lot of things. There's not enough time for me to talk about some of the things I wanted to talk about, but I will say this. I played you an Aretha Franklin track badly, I know, but you must see Amazing Grace, which is the salvaged film footage of her 1972 performance live in a Los Angeles Baptist church of her seminal gospel album, Amazing Grace. Like, you have to see it. If you, even if you're not a big Aretha fan, once you see this movie, you will be converted, because she gives you a lesson in vocal dynamics, melodics, fervor, how to touch an audience. I can't recommend it enough. You have to see Amazing Grace. And just finally, you know, looking at the news today, you know, our news is so devastating so often. And so I want to offer prayers of healing and strength to director John Singleton. He's currently in a coma, apparently, after suffering a major stroke. Now, we had already heard that he had a stroke, but I don't think we knew the director was in a coma. So The Hollywood Reporter is reporting that his mom, Sheila Ward, had to apply to be his temporary conservator because he can't overlook his own finances and business dealings. And apparently he was in a major deal negotiation for a new project. And so in order not to let that fall to the wayside and have his, you know, affairs looked after while he's hospitalized in California, you know, his mom was appointed in California Superior Court today. So the document, according to The Hollywood Reporter, the document detailed some previously undisclosed circumstances about his stroke that he had on April 17th. So the director, Oscar-nominated director of Boys in the Hood, the co-creator of the series Snowfall, we wish you all the best, rapid healing. So that's all for this week's Words on Flicks show. Happy birthday to Shakespeare. Have a fantastic week. I'll see you here again. And thanks for listening. I really do appreciate it. Enjoy. Good night.
You're looking at me, huh? You're looking at me? How'd you get out of this place, huh?
I don't know. How did we get in here?
Like a maze. You just go round and round and round. It's like being on the inside of a birthday cake.
Yeah.
This is from Kiss Me, Kate. Goodbye.
Good evening.